Chapter 20. This was vindication. This was confirmation of everything he had been working for since the palace, drawing the threads together, tying them into the cord that led him here, at last, to the source, to the architect. His mind was working well, very well, much faster now. The fortress, strangely enough, was helping with that. He could see things in the dark, flashes of memories and ideas, and they were the things that had brought him here, his angels of perception, the fragments of the whole. The Xenos was there too, of course, goading him, driving him onward. He had long since stopped being surprised or shocked by its regular appearances, reflected in the black crystal surfaces, caught at the edge of sight when he turned his head, growling something unintelligible behind the speech of others. Running helped, too. His body felt looser now. He could feel blood in his armour and guessed that something had broken somewhere, but he couldn't attend to that now. He was awake again. It was still hard to breathe, but if he just kept going, just kept moving, it would all be fine. He couldn't stop. If he stopped, he might hear Spinoza's doubts again. He might see her face rather than its face, with that pious, insufferable concern written all over it. She was a good acolyte, Spinoza. He was fond of her, despite her stiffness, her obsession with the regulations of their ordo. She would regret not coming with him when all was finally revealed. She would regret missing her chance to understand. Khazad loped alongside him, running freely, almost invisible in the gloom. That was a reassurance, if he was honest. Now that he was back in the tunnels, heading through the blood-soaked chambers with their markers of madness and excruciation, it was good to have a blade at his side, one who had already proved her worth. Perhaps Khazad would have made her better acolyte. Perhaps, as fate willed it, that had been Spinoza's function all along, to bring the assassin into the fold. Perhaps after this, another adjustment would have to be made. "The wound," he muttered as he hobbled along. "The wound."
"Why do they say it?"
Khazad asked, lighting the way ahead with the gold-silver illumination from her blade. Kral thought quickly. His mind was racing now, burning ahead. It was so much easier to think in here.
"They are soul-bound," he whispered. "They see things. They know things, and they feel things. They see things even the Magister did not." He chuckled. "A wound in the galaxy. There is some doubt as to their current status and reporting reliability. Bachan was a greater fool than his master. I hear the voices of a thousand worlds. There is a link. The anomaly. The Xenos. The dead of the Astronomicon."
Khazad did not reply. She seemed to have sunk into a kind of battle trance and uttered few words now. She too appeared to have been enhanced by the psychic pressure in the air, stripped down to her essentials, shorn of all things but her remaining death oath. The chambers were getting bigger, becoming finer. Dark crystal surfaces were everywhere, reflecting the images of horror and pain, like augmenting reflectors. Senior adepts slumped among the dead now, their fur-lined robes sticky with blood, their teeth pulled and their eyes gouged. In one hall, something ceremonial, he guessed, going by the proscenium arch and ranked stages, dozens were strung up, flayed, changed, damaged, stretched. Someone had scrawled "The Wound" across a wall made of mirrors, tracing the words out in bloody handprints. One of the killers was still there, gorging on raw flesh, her own nightshade robes disarranged and her hair stiff with blood over an enlarged skull. Her eyes, like all of their eyes, were black in black, empty, pupilless, but still somehow capable of something like sight. She screamed at them, whirling her blackwood staff until it whipped the bloody flecks into a storm around her. Khazad did what Khazad did best, darting and dancing in close, cutting the staff up with two rapid flickers of her blade. But the woman blasted her away with her fist clench, then rose up unsteadily into the air, her robes fluttering. Kral shot her. He shot her again. He shot her a third time. His aim was impeccable. His reactions were superlative. His fingers appeared to be bleeding, and there was something sharp and urgent taking place in his chest cavity, but he could not pay any attention to that.
The creature bent over itself as the bullets hit, jerking back and forth before being driven back against an old hexagrammatic ward graven into the crystal walls. When she hit it, she screamed and thrashed, her robes bursting into blue-edged flame. She couldn't get away from it. She stuck fast, like an insect on a pin, shrieking and writhing. Kral watched it unfold, enthralled. Khazad got back to her feet and hobbled to his side.
"Must keep moving," she muttered.
So they did, leaving the witch to burn. They raced away from the hall, entered the next, crept unseen through the procession of chambers, each one of them as black in their armor as the fortress around them. As they hurried, Kral found that he couldn't stop talking, even if it was only to himself now.
"Battle language," he murmured, remembering how he had worked it out. "One of many hundreds in use, an esoteric dialect based on pre-Vandaya lexical forms. Suits this place. I told Palf it would be worth making a study of them, all of them, their origins, their types, but he never agreed, and now look where it has led us."
He halted suddenly, drawing up before a baroque altarpiece encrusted with blinded angels and hawk-faced lion-bodied sentinels.
"Where is Gorgias?" he asked,
aware for the first time that the skull was not there.
"The skull does not come,"
Khazad said, prowling ahead, her boots sucking on the wet floor. Kral shook his head.
"Even him," he said mournfully.
Then they were moving again, limping, scampering, hugging the dark, squelching through the dampness where the violence had been. The vibrations in the air became even more intense. A pressure built up, making his sinuses ache. The silence was broken now, underpinned by a low, grinding thrum, one that ran through every structure and shivered every column. They passed through a long, narrow capillary passageway before breaking out into the biggest hall they had yet encountered. The change in air pressure was palpable. They crept across the floor. Giant supporting columns glinted at them in the gloom, each one engraved with defaced warding runes and astrological devices. Kral caught sight of the Xenos again, peering out from behind one of the pillars, smiling at him, before darting back into hiding, and he almost smiled back at it.
"Fighters!"
Khazad warned, suddenly racing over to the chamber's central aisle. Kral went after her, tripping over an extended arm on the floor, then slipping on the still warm matter underfoot. A tangle of bodies lay in the open centre of the hall. Most were just as the others had been, acolytes and menials of the fortress, clad in nightshade, their sunlight-starved flesh as white as alabaster. But among them were others, soldiers, clad in well-made carapace armour. Khazad dropped down beside the nearest of them, bringing her snarling blade up close to illuminate it. The battle plate was dark grey, unmarked, with a narrow slit helm. She looked up at Kral.
"Same ones as before," she said.
"Good," Kral said, looking up and out into the shadows. From up ahead, more sounds could be made out, only faintly, but there nevertheless.
"They're still fighting. Retreating, but still fighting."
He could smell it now. He could feel it, too, rising up from the floors, permeating the crystal around them, curling up like smoke. It made him feel as he had done at the Eternity Gate, only this time the blood rush made him exhilarated rather than terrified. Something immense lay up ahead, something burning and thundering like an unending watercourse. He pictured it in his mind's eye, recalling the detail of the hololith perfectly. He knew where they had to go, but time was running out. They would be lowering the internal doors soon, shutting out the madness, believing that by locking themselves down, they could ride out the storm.
"Hurry, assassin,"
Kral said, getting up and limping down the long aisle.
"Hurry, hurry, must not be late."
Khazad looked down at the corpse again. She kicked it once, watching the head rock. She looked around her at the mass of limbs and skin. Then she came after him, her blade crackling in the dark. Rivas slumped into a corner. 10 of his stormtroopers had made it in, but 2 of those were badly wounded. One of them couldn't speak, it seemed. Gorgias was darting back and forth, caught between his usual fury and a more unusual sense of remorse. The skull didn't know what to do now. Rivas
could sympathize. Again, busied himself with the control column, trying to find out more about the situation. The rest recharged their weapons, wrapped bandages around wounds, recited battle litanies. If Spinoza had been shocked by what had just happened, she didn't initially show it. She worked with Hegain for a while, trying to figure out how far they had come and what to do next. Rivas attended to his weapon, ensuring it could be used again. His sense of panic was fading now, leaving a hollow feeling in its wake. He remembered the custodians. He remembered the endless hours of training, the desire to learn. He remembered the snarl of their golden halberds. Spinoza came over then, squatting down in front of him.
"Thank you, Captain," she said quietly. Somehow, that made it much worse.
"You were right," he said, for the want of anything better to say.
"We were right," she corrected.
"Growl is not himself," he said. "But the assassin."
"Be thankful they are together, even in misjudgment."
She made to get up.
"Come, we cannot linger here."
They rose and went over to the central column. Hegain looked up at them from his glowing lens port.
"Hard to get much more out, in truth," he said. "All instruments are playing badly. But the Lord Crowl was right. I think they left things too long, trying to fix them. They have not issued distress calls, or if they did, they were not answered."
Spinoza rested a weary hand on the column's edge.
"Then we need to do so for them. I take it we do not have the numbers to do much here on our own."
Hegain shook his head.
"There were thousands stationed in these sections. If even a fraction of them survived, we will not last long."
"Can we get back to the gunships?" Rivas asked,
trying to make sense of the schematic.
"Possibly," said Hegain, indicating the respective positions. "But they have limited range transmitters and would not carry verification markers for this location."
Spinoza leaned further over.
"That is a communications tower, is it not?"
she asked, pointing out a spire jutting from the fortress's edge, close to their current position.
"Is it active?"
"Everything is inactive, Lord," Hegain said. "But if we could get there, it might be salvageable."
Rivas calculated the distances.
"Not far," he said. "If we move now, before more of them got our scent, we could make it."
"And we could broadcast a signal from there to the palace?" Spinoza asked. "If the equipment could be made functional," said Hegain, "to wherever you like."
Spinoza looked over at Rivas, who nodded his agreement. The interrogator stood tall then, turning to address the remaining members of the detachment.
"You came here under the command of the Lord Crowl," she told them. "In his absence, you are now under mine. This fortress is at risk of destruction, and that cannot be countenanced. We must strike out to secure the tower and broadcast a priority distress signal. Then, and only then, if we can, we shall attempt to go after the Inquisitor. You have served with him for a long time. You have been loyal to him. I understand that. But I need to know, now, that you will do this for me."
Rivas stood at her side, making his feelings plain. Hegain did the same. Gorgias swung low.
"Affirmativo,"
he rasped, though with less of his usual ebullience.
"Now, quick, quick."
None of the others demurred. Spinoza turned back to Rivas.
"Very well, then," she said. "Prepare yourselves. We move out."